yourself to that authority anymore because he already gave you the sentence. So it's at the same time you're at your most depressed and at your most free.
I'm recording the next couple of things that are said just to go ahead and have this on, if y'all are okay with that.
I think that the idea of authority, you were talking about it being political, I think that authority is defined by you. Because if you, I mean, life and death, anybody can kill you. Every single person.
Good.
So I think that he can become free because he decides that he is no longer respecting that authority. I think
all right. So that's the key there. Self-liberation. Self-liberation is only a struggle until you realize that you are your own authority. And then the question becomes one of, what are the material conditions that are trying to limit me being my own authority? Right? But if the structure of the society is such that it discounts your authority, discounts your power, discounts that you know your life better than anybody. And some of the things I'm about to say probably make me sound like, instead of an anarchist, could make me sound like I'm a supporter of Trump. But the point, of course, here is that either you are ruled by another, or you're ruled by yourself. And what are our technical terms in philosophy for this? Ruled by another is, or ruled by yourself is, that'd be the easier one. Autonomy. Thank you, Robbie, for whispering that. Autonomy. And that would make ruled by another.
Autocracy.
Huh?
Autocracy.
Not autocracy. That's not a bad one. That's a form of this other kind of rule. It's what's the rule for other, what's the word for other in Greek? I know y'all don't study Greek anymore, but heteronomy. Either you are in the world heteronomously, that is, other people give you the rules, and you follow the rules, and you have no rule, or you have no way of making your own way in the world based on your experiences and your own thinking. Or you have autonomy. So this is another one of these notions that just pops up 200 years ago. Right? This word means nomi, nomos, means law. Auto means self. So a law to yourself or self-rule. And of course, we already said that. Nomos means law, so this means heteronomy means other. Hetero means other. So, this becomes a question for the existentialist. If it's really the case that these guys who've been going on about this stuff now for a couple hundred years are right, this is what they're saying. Okay? If I am an autonomous being, notice I'm not using the word individual. That word pops up in existential writing, but I try to stay away from it. But if you are an autonomous person, then why do you struggle under the rules of others? Let's start with this idea. What is it that we all share in common? What can we all say is common to all of us?
We're all alive.
Wait, I'm sorry. Blake, what'd you say? That wasn't you. Who said that? You said
it. We're all alive.
We're all alive.
Self-preservation.
Self-preservation.
We're all going to die.
We're all going to die. To say we're all alive is to say we're going to die. To say that we're not going to die is to preserve ourselves. Right? Okay, so we all share that in common. What else do we share in common? What?
Just taxes.
Taxes. Well, Benjamin Franklin would be happy to know he's an existentialist. Yes, debts and taxes. Okay, so we all are alive. we live, which means we die, but let's just make this the, we're born and we die. That's what living is. Okay. And in order to live, we self-preserve. What?
As citizens, we're all subject to the authority of government.
Oh, okay. So we live in a community. Every community has a structure, right? But is there a single person in here who lives in the community that you created?
We live in communities for security.
That's a part of our preservation idea, right? So community is preservation because we're social animals. We can let that republic always flow in here. We're social animals, okay? It's part of our preservation. But the issue, of course, again now is the community preserves. And as the, it not only preserves, it conserves. Right? Which means it goes on. Preserves life, conserves itself. It goes on, which means you will not find a human being, very rarely, it's very rare, you're not find, generally not finding a human being not thrown into a community already. So not only do we share the fact that we live, and that our living happens in a community, we share the fact that we are thrown into the world. Heidegger 101. I didn't mean to do the Nazi salute when I said Heidegger. That's just subconscious. I'm sorry. It says, we are thrown into the world. Heil sein. Anyway. Okay. So we have that in common. We're thrown into the world. So what does that mean about every one of us? If we're thrown into a world, we're thrown into a community that we didn't make, or communities that we didn't make, you know, even if you come over here from another country, like some of my friends who come from Iran or China or Taiwan or Japan or you know, whatever countries they come from, they were born into a world, thrown into a world that was not the one that they made, and they came to the United States, which is, you know, they may be here by choice, if not by utter necessity, but it's still not something they made themselves, right? So we're thrown into a world that's already underway. We're thrown into the already underway. If we're thrown into the already underway, and we unfortunately end up inside of a society that does not provide the education to remind us that we're autonomous, right? Because of this already underwayness that we're thrown into, it's very easy to slip into heteronomy and just let other people decide your whole life for you. Right? Why? Well, because for one thing, something else we share. We learn by starting where someone else stopped. Right? You don't get out of bed every morning and rediscover standing up. You don't get out of bed every morning. You don't go to bed every morning and rebuild a bed. Excuse me, every night. Well, maybe morning, some of y'all. You don't go to bed and rebuild the bed every night, right? You don't rediscover electricity every single time you want to use the lights. You don't. So we live not only in a world that communally structured is already underway. It's just, you know, we just kind of have a tendency of just sort of taking in what's already there and making use of it. So one of the things that we share, besides the fact that we live in a community of preservation and conservation, besides that we're already thrown into the already underway, we make do. We're make doers. What I mean by that is if you run along and you come along with somebody who's already figured out how to make electricity and utilize it, go along and say, well, I want to do that myself. And then go off and do it again. You're going to make do with what you've got. Now then, somebody in here tell me how lights work.
Electricity.
How do they really work?
Well,
it's about as good as you can get most of the time.
Specifically, or just like...
No, really. Could you design a light in a light bulb? Could you build the electrical matrix? Could you do... Do you understand how all those things work together? Nathan, do you...
I mean, we perceive it in this exact same way as we perceive magic.
Yeah, I mean, it might as well be. This is something else. So inside this make do, if we can say that living in a community already kind of predetermines... are already underway, and that we make do, then we have to figure out, in all that we have to start asking ourselves, what are all the ways that we make do? Now, I've done this with a few of y'all before. So if I've done this, don't say anything. Why does this fall?
Gravity. Because you dropped it.
Because I dropped it. But why, when I drop it, does it fall?
Gravity.
Except gravity is not a why. It's not a why. It wasn't a why for Newton. You can look at, don't believe me? Go look at the Principia Mathematica. And look at the general scope. The Principia Mathematica does not present gravity as a why. God is the why. Gravity is a description of how things fall. But we make do with gravity. Gravity becomes our doctrine. It's a dogma we have. Almost everything, and Keith doesn't believe in gravity. Now I know he's a continentalist because he's so anti-science, he doesn't believe in gravity.
Earth is flat, right?
Or the earth is flat. Or he said, so y'all can say it. Keith says that the sun comes up every day in the east and sets in the west, and that's our experience of the sun, and that, it's merely a dogma. That the earth is spinning around the sun, right? But it's not that it's not true. It's true. But very few people in this room or in any room I've ever been in, and this includes rooms that are mostly filled with people 40 or 50 years old that are scholars, do anything more than make do with science. What the fuck is that thing on the wall over there? What is it for? What does it tell you? What does it tell you? Is there anybody in here who's had chemistry?
Atomic weight and mass.
I know the top left is hydrogen.
I know that as you go left, it gets lighter, and as you go right, it gets heavier. That says something. It's gas, it's matter, it's stuff. Okay, now then, who here's seen an atom? Who here has seen a quark? Who here has ever experienced a superstring?
I don't think we can.
I mean, you can argue that you have, considering everything's made of that stuff.
That's what you say.
You're right.
You're making do with atomism, right? I know, the real issue, of course, here is, and I'm not saying, again, this is exactly how continentalists get called anti-scientific. We're not anti-scientific. We're anti two things. Scientism that reduces the world to nothing but what science can demonstrate to be the case. Which would mean the world is constantly expanding and changing because science couldn't demonstrate something 300 years ago that they can demonstrate now. Right? So we're against a scientism that reduces the world down to only what scientists can demonstrate. And we're also against the idea that when people make use of scientific knowledge as scientific doctrine, that they're doing something that is dissimilar to people who make use of religious knowledge. They are not doing something dissimilar to people who make use of religious knowledge. If what you say is being said because it's a doctrine you learned and not something that you actually understand and can make use of, then you are not thinking, you're making do, and that's what doctrines are. That's what dogmas are. There's a whole slew of dogmas. And in phenomenology, we call these, more simply, presuppositions. That part of being alive inside of a community where you've been thrown into the already underway is that you take on doctrines, dogmas, worldviews, and presuppositions to make do and not have to discover the wheel every single time you decide to get on your bicycle. Okay? Positioning yourself upon what's already there. Okay? It's not wrong to have presuppositions, but if you don't challenge your presuppositions, and if you don't even know you have presuppositions, well, you can't challenge your presuppositions if you don't know you have presuppositions. And you actually don't know how your presuppositions get in the way. Here's a favorite one also I like to use. White, black. Now, I'm not talking about this in terms of racism. I'm talking about this in terms of color, all right? If you look at white and black, what is it about white and black? Tell us about white and black. Is white the absence of color, or all the color?
All the color.
And black is
a void.
The lack of color. But oddly enough, the etymology of the word black is white. The etymology of the word black is blanc. It means blank. Both of these words meant blank originally. And over the course of a few hundred years, we've come to identify, I'm not wearing it, but we've come to identify white and black. Right? Two kinds of blank. Right? Without color in the sense of something that varies from the two. Right? And then, of course, this has, and it's odd, isn't it, that then inside of this being thrown into the already underway, the presuppositions about white and black are used as a strict disjunction, which becomes the basis of racial theory. Give me a fucking break. Please. Yes.
So what is the relationship between these dogmas that we hold and maybe some kind of actual, like for example with the apple, we say gravity. We know there is probably real reason the apples fall that we can't internalize because of limitations of our own mind and limitations of expression. So does the fact that we have these dogmas, does that implicate that there is a real reason in some cases, all cases, or is it really just we're grasping at straws, where we use language because it's the best possible mode of expression we have, but there is nothing beyond that? Or are we circling in on
it? As Jaspers is going to tell you, what Kierkegaard and Nietzsche bring to the fore for us, as the exceptions to thinking. So he's going to actually, Jaspers, the piece you're going to read for Thursday, Jaspers is going to call, he's going to basically lay out the groundwork for doing Kierkegaard and Nietzsche next week, and he's going to lay out the groundwork for thinking how there are exceptions to philosophizing that comes before, so that they break the philosophy that comes before them. And part of that is, they're the ones who basically say, everything is interpretation. And after that, nothing's ever the same. And so existentialism especially becomes about if you really want to grasp autonomy, you have to learn not only to interpret the world, but interpret yourself and interpret the things that you come across, right? That there is a hermeneutics being the word for interpretation, there is a hermeneutical necessity to our being human. And that we have to examine where we find ourselves in the world, look at our own experiences. So I don't want to treat you merely as objects that have to be filled up with knowledge. right? I want to interpret the world with you, right? But yeah, there's no, the idea here, of course, this is another one of those things that drives analytic philosophers and philosophers of science and some scientists up the wall with continental philosophers, because they want there to be something real that requires no interpretation. That there's a real world that requires no interpretation. That we experience that world and there's no need to interpret it. Kierkegaard and Nietzsche say, and again, this is the point that gets lost here, that in our making do, if a scientist says that the world is made of atoms and you just accept that because you will not be able to follow all of the reasoning behind why the world is made up of atoms and be there for all of the experimentation that proves that the world is made up of atoms, so you take for granted that the expert knows what they're talking about, right? It's easy to misinterpret those things. And it's an aspect of those things that the language the scientists themselves use sometimes gets in the way of what they're trying to do. Worst mistake they ever made for trying to get people to understand climate change was to call it global warming. It was bad rhetoric. It was a bad metaphor. It was, even if it's a description of what's happening. Right?
It leaves it open for people to say,
open. Yeah, and then also the term climate change. Shit. Everybody, if you're in Texas, you know climate's always changing. Of course, that's the weather. It's not the same thing as the climate. But that's the problem, isn't it? That if people don't know that climate is more than weather, the climate is a more encompassing idea. I don't want to start sounding like Bob Froman. The climate is a more encompassing idea, then they're not actually, because they're just going to make do. They don't give a rat's ass about the climate and weather, except they want to know, we don't care about climate and weather, except we want to know, do I need to take an umbrella today? Or should I wear shorts? Or is it okay to wear sandals, or is it going to rain all day? Blah, blah, blah. Right? So, again, this is the issue. This is the real issue. We may do. Now I want to kind of like bring all this together with something that Jose Arteaga-Gasset said, and it's something that I think bears on our reading. And it goes to the questions that y'all came up with. Again, great questions. And I love it. And we're going to do this a lot. So y'all bear in mind for tomorrow, we're going to do something similar. Right? I know this text we're going to be reading is super thick, but we're going to try to do this again. But the point is, Arteaga-Gasset says this in a book called Ideas y Creencias. Ideas y Creencias. We hold ideas. We inhabit beliefs. Ideas may become beliefs over the course of time. But when people first begin holding an idea, they're holding that idea in the habit, in the inhabitation of the beliefs that they've inherited in the already underway. That's why 150 years later, there's still a large section of American culture that just simply has never built into the house of their beliefs evolution. It's an idea they hold, and they hold very gingerly and let gravity do its work when they drop it. Or it's an idea they hold inside their habitat. They've held, you know, they kind of hold it and take it around. Inside their belief system of God as the creator. And they're okay with evolution as the function of how God creates. And in this regard, Ortega is very much in line with Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, and he's following Husserl and a man named Wilhelm Dilthey, and is parallel with Jaspers and parallel with Heidegger and Gadamer, because he basically says that, and again now, here's the thing, we're going to run out and you're going to say Keith doesn't believe in gravity, and he believes that the earth doesn't move and the sun goes around it, and then he said that science isn't really anything other than literature. That science has the same effect on most people as literature does. Because it's just an idea most people entertain, and it's not, and unless it's something they can make do with, they just drop it and move on. Nobody questions lights, nobody questions atom bombs, nobody questions bullets. Right? All that Newtonian shit and Einsteinian stuff, people can make do with that. You can't make do with evolution, and you can't unless you really want to kind of get into what husbandry is, right? Animal husbandry is, but you can't really make do with evolution, and you can't make do with climate science. That's the problem with it. So it's just literary to most people. And that's a question of you really want to make these things a part of where you, and this is everybody in this room. You work in the world towards your autonomy by developing what Jaspers calls your philosophical faith. And your philosophical faith is your ability to learn science and utilize it to question the world and your place in the world, and to understand religion and utilize it to question reality and your place in reality. Okay? But what we're going to be doing with Jaspers all semester is we're going to be slowly but surely trying to understand what philosophical faith is and why rational faith, as Kant would call it, is a necessary component of being in the world as these creatures who live in community with each other, already thrown into the already underway, making do, deciding what ideas they're going to add to their habitation and what beliefs they're going to take away from it. This is what we struggle to do. Okay, now then, is there anybody here who wasn't here the first half of class? Is there anybody here who was here the first half of class but is not here anymore? I forgot to do roll. Can I do roll real fast? This will help me remember y'all's names again.